I would like first of all to qualify and to ask a question. The qualification is that even though the title contains mathematics or computer science or whatever, there is very little to it that will teach you anything new. So if you are looking for something beyond high school mathematics, this is not the right lecture, and everybody is entitled to leave whenever he or she would like to do. The second question, I think I don't have to ask it, but because I know most of the faces, it's always face to ask if there is an archaeologist in the audience. I gave the same talk on Monday in Marburg in Germany, and there were four archaeologists, and then I asked them, do you know what is a normal to a surface is? And they didn't know what a normal to a surface is, so I had to explain.
Why should they?
Sorry? So I assume that everybody knows about it. Okay. So one said, everybody of you probably imagine archaeology is something like this. And this is really a picture of a photograph of a archaeology in action in a site which is called Tel Dor on the coast of the Mediterranean in Israel. I'm a member of this the group of these people, and many times this name will return. The question which I would like to start with, and this is another thing which I have to be careful when archaeologists are present, is whether archaeology is a science. This will be clarified in a little while, but I really would like to do it by asking the question, how can a mathematician or physicist or a scientist be integrated or do something, be involved in active archaeological research? To understand that, we have to think of what are the steps in the archaeological research are and where the mathematical person can or scientist can get into. Well, the first stage is excavations. You've seen it. Everybody, mathematician, non-mathematician, whatever you are, who is interested in doing archaeology on the excavation stage and is sufficiently able-bodied to bring up a basket full of dirt is most welcome. Come to me after the lecture, I'll send you to the right place. The next stage is, once you have found what you found, you would like to document them in an orderly way so that you can retrieve them and analyze them. And in this kind of, in these two important stages, that's where a scientist can come into, because exactly in this place are coming the physical, the chemical, the biological, and also computerized methods which help the archaeologists to do their job. But this is not their job. Archaeology starts to be interesting, I believe, in the fourth stage. This is the interpretation. This is building up from the sparse jigsaw puzzle of the finds, building up culture, building up civilization, building up religion, building up beliefs, commerce, economy, international relationship. And all these things have to do with human beings, with human societies, and I think that we, scientists, at least myself, are not equipped for this. And that's where I think most interest is. And when this comes about, I say, chapeau, monsieur, now it is your turn, I just learned there to learn. But at least, on the first two stages, one can study. It is very difficult to interact with archaeologists. For me, being a physicist, it was very difficult to interact with a mathematician. But because of some good friends, some of them are sitting here, I learned slowly by slowly to know or to understand what I don't understand when they say something. With archaeologists, it's the other way around. So you need some kind of sovlanut? Sovlanut? How?
Patience.
Not patience, sovlanot.
Tolerance.
Say it again?
Tolerance.
Tolerance and patience to continue. So I'd like to speak about this part. And in particular, I chose only one of the subjects in which I am now working on with these people, the archaeologists. And this is computerized methods for the study of pottery. My group consists of several people. The color code is that red is archaeology and blue is the sciences, mathematics or physics. And as you see, many of them, most of them are archaeologists. This fellow is very special because he has a BA in mathematics and is now doing his PhD in archaeology. And I think that what is the strength of my group is exactly because we are interdisciplinary and we talk to each other more than many others. When I show this picture and I ask archaeologists, can you believe that this is equal to this? They say, you are crazy. You'll understand it immediately and you'll agree with me that this is much nicer than this, but let's see what will come up. Now, when I gave the talk in Bristol, I think, Michael Berry came to me and said, why don't you call this talk Crack Pottery? I said, well, that's your choice, call it as you wish. But then I remembered a true story about a physicist, a Nobel Prize physicist, actually George Charpak. And he, while strolling with this journalist through the lecture, the Louvre, the Charpak was talking about the feasibility of reading the sound waves engraved on the ancient pottery as it spun on the wheel, recording the potter's conversations like an old 78 round per minute record. Now, this, I believe, is crack pottery, and I'm not going to talk about it. So, have any of you seen a potter at work? One, two. So, that's not enough. So, I'll show you a potter at work. So, this is the potter. You see his body and his legs, actually. This is the wheel. These are his hands. This is a piece of clay, a very soft material full of water, out of which he is now going to produce a ball, a drinking ball or a ball. In front of it, of him, in front of the wheel, there is a ball which we gave him as an example. And he was supposed to produce 50 of them. Now, watch it. He does not use any measuring device. I'll show you how he's doing it. Oops, sorry. This is another one. He starts with the clay, and by moving his fingers and his palms, he shapes it in a little bit of water, in a continuous motion of his fingers, and within less than a minute, a ball is almost finished. He will take then, just to be sure, he marked the size that he would like. This is this is his ruler. And you saw he made it exactly the same shape. I mean the size without even measuring it. So he has his motor habits or motor education so he can produce anything which he just copies. And what he's doing now is to take a wire and he cuts it. While passing the wire along, he cuts the connection to the other pieces of the clay. He stops the thing, and you saw how long time it took him. This is real life. And now it starts the second one, and you see how similar is the second one to the first, and he can produce like that hundreds. He is a professional potter. You saw that he was defining the rim, a very important concept, the rim, the lip. Measure it, you see, exactly the right shape, right size. Taking the wire, taking the inside, connecting it. And this is number two, finished. He cuts it, stops the wheel, put it on a plate to dry. After he did many of them, you see some of them. 2 days later, he takes them, they're a little bit more dry. Now he works to remove the remains from the base. So he centers it. He removes the remains with this little instrument which he has, cleans it. And then it goes to the fire, and then it becomes hard. And then the business is finished, and you have within half a day, he has 50 plates. They have to dry, of course, to be burned afterwards, but that's the end of the story. So this is the how the potter works, and the technique is now something like 5,000 years old, at least in the Middle East, or even more. Now, when you think about pottery, You ask why pottery and not other things. Well, pottery has many reasons. The main reason of my interest, because of biblical or Palestinian or Israeli archaeology, is that of the periods of interest, there was hardly anything written. Even though it was historical periods, it's not like Egypt, where one found a lot of archives or royal inscriptions. Palestine was much more poor in that respect, and there is hardly anything written apart from the Bible, of course. So what you really find in big abundance are the pottery, sherds, the fragments, and you find them all over the place. Now, they are very good in order to get an idea about temporal and spatial distributions, and the reasons are the following. First of all, a pot usually has a short lifetime. It breaks. So you can associate its use from production to the finish of use with a very short period of time. At the same time, once it is broken, the sherds don't really, after they are broken and discarded, they don't change in time almost. They remain fixed by their shape at least. Second reason of importance is the universality. They appear everywhere. They are very abundant. In every excavation, you find millions per excavation. And they have various characteristics which you can use afterwards for the comparison, for the determination where they came from. Shapes are very different. Functions are very different. Sizes. I bring here a picture of a very large jar, and in order to have a scale, you see the dinosaur next to it, and you can see the comparison. This is a small one. This is a ball. Actually, I think this was the ball which the potter was trying to imitate. They have different production techniques, different materials. You can do chemical analysis. You can do mineralogical analysis. The finish is different. The decorations are different. Glazing is different. And all these small or important differences help you to locate a pot within the temporal or spatial context, and then learn about what you want to learn in archaeology. To make this clear and the importance clear, imagine that we are now in year 3000, and we are excavating what used to be once the mound or the tell of Detroit. Detroit is the place where cars are now being used, but 3,000 years hence, they will be, it will be a big, big mound, and the archaeologists will come and dig in it. What will they find? They'll find layers with cars or car remains. Now, they'll go and excavate in the Ford production site, and they'll find T10, which has this particular characteristic, T50, I don't know, with this particular characteristic, Mustang, Lincoln, Ka, and each of them represents a period. And by that, you can do stratification. And if you excavate the mound of Los Angeles, and you find also Mustang cars, you say, they had some contacts between them along such a big difference, and they were cotemporal. They had the same time. The same thing in the analogous for the cars in Detroit are the pottery fragments in antiquity. They were used and they are found at every household. They were the daily houseware of the place. Most of them were not beautiful. They were not decorated. Just the things which you find at home, you eat from, your child breaks them, you scold him, you throw it out. And then 3,000 years later comes Uzis Milansky and digs it up and makes measurements and gives lectures about it. But you have to remember, therefore, that most of the material is simple, where without decoration, without glazer, which were done in exactly in the same way as I showed you in the film. So that's why we are interested in pottery, and in particular, because most of them have only shape to talk about, we speak about only about shapes. Well, here comes the next stage, from the Middle Bronze Age on, and some people say also from even earlier times on, the pots at the Middle East were produced by the wheel, as I showed you. This is not true in Middle America. The Maya culture, all these cultures did not know the wheel. They produce beautiful pottery without wheel. In the Middle East, it's quite common to believe that from 3,000 or 2,000 years before Christ, pottery was mostly produced on wheel, and therefore much of the research focuses on cylindrically symmetric shapes. Now here is a cylindrical symmetric bowl which is cut, and of course it is completely determined by the profile or by the boundary profile, so reduce the amount of information from a three-dimensional object into a line. Now, I don't know, I try to emphasize it while you saw the movie, that the rim has a very important role in all this analysis, because that's where the potter has to do something special to leave the instrument, the vessel, and it is customary in archaeology to analyze of all the millions and millions of fragments, only those which have a part of the rim in them. So the fragments, which are called indicative fragments, and I shall only talk about those. Well, what kind of problems do you want to analyze? Or do we analyze? I give you a few examples. I shall speak in particular about this example later, so I don't tell anything. In the 1600 before Christ, there was in Egypt the second intermediate period of disorder, and the Hyksos tribes from Canaan, and here are the picture, were ruling this Egypt for about 200 years. It was a time where culture was not, I mean, writing and archives were not in existence, and it is very difficult to find the correct stratigraphy and the time ordering. And in particular, in their capital, Tel Adaba, it is called now, they were trying to get the stratification by comparing the drinking cups. These are their profiles. A profile always shown, half of it is shown because the other half is the same as the first half. And what you see is there is a tendency along the time that the cups open up. So by just measuring the ratio between the radius and the height, you can more or less position the area where you are within a certain time interval. It's very rough, but everything is rough in archaeology, and that is the problem. This is from Tel Dor. These are drinking bowls, and what is important about them is that at this time in stratigraphy, the Philistines, the old Philistines, not the present Philistines, who came from the Greek islands to the Mediterranean, ruined Dor and took over. And the question is whether this introduced a new cultural revolution, because they came from a completely different world. And usually you see that when there is a conquest, there is a change of style. And the question was whether this change corresponds to a continuity, in which in this then the tradition or the culture was changing slowly, or does it mean a break in continuity, and it shows that the Philistine ruined the place and resettled it, rather than mingled with the society, adopted their customs, and so these are the kind of questions that one is asking, and this is where we come in the analysis. Well, there are many problems. First of all, if you want to do a proper analysis, and a proper analysis corresponds to a very large number of fragments, indicative fragments which are found, something like 10 to the 4th per season, you have to have an efficient data acquisition and presentation. You have to have a good storage method and a database organization. This is not very difficult. I mean, it's okay. That's what we already solved. Methodological problem is the definition of shape similarity. You want to compare shapes. What do we mean by that? We have to introduce metric in the space of shapes. And you can introduce many, many possible metrics depending on the archaeological sense. You want to select what is the classification criterion, and then you have to ask what is the basic assumption. The basic assumption is that a style, a shape, represent a period and a place and location. This is correct for T10. T10 were produced only in Detroit. And they were produced by a machine. So they replicated themselves. Here we have potters, human, two potters in the same village. Can they make the same pot, the same style? The potter himself, can he make the same style? Can he reproduce himself? This is a very important question that one has to ask and to answer. And then the question, of course, is how to do this large number of fragments, and they have many possible shapes. So the question is, and the goal is to find computerized typology, classification, and correlations among all these possible shapes. Traditionally, this was done all by hand. So out of the tens of thousands of pots per season, they would have chosen about 150, 200 fragments which are representative. This is the kind of fragments that we have. You see, this is a three-dimensional realization of a fragment. It's very small. Or this one is a typical one. And what you do is the following. First of all, because you have indicative fragments only, you have the rim. The rim is tangent to a plane which is parallel to the wheel plane, perpendicular to the axis of rotation. So what an archaeologist is doing, he takes the fragment, and he takes a plane, and first of all, he tries to put it such that it will be tangent. It's not very easy if the fragment is small. It has only a small angle. But suppose that he's doing it, he or she, then he knows how to position it on this circular coordinate table. By this, he or she can find the radius, and then measure a little bit here and there and produce some kind of a mean profile. Here are the mean profiles, and this is a part of a PhD thesis, of a typical archaeology PhD. Every PhD has two volumes. One volume is the interpretation, the story, the description, various other, and the other one is just page after page after page after page of such drawings. Suppose that now you want to do any kind of typology or any kind of a comparison. You have two cities, Oxford and Cambridge, you excavated them, you want to know, was there any connection between Cambridge and Oxford? So you have to take this volume and the volume for Cambridge, for Oxford, and start to lift through and to say, ah, here, this one is, and you don't even, what is the criteria, what are the criteria of selection? There is a lot of bias in this selection. And the rate of work of a typical and a good artist is about 10 to 20 fragments a day. Very slow. And very inaccurate, a lot of bias. And even the question, what is the real mean profile, remains problematic. Well, in this part, and this is a severe problem in archaeology, and it means that you cannot analyze your data. You cannot compare. You cannot know if, you know, they say that Joshua ruined this city and this city. You start digging this city and this city. How can you compare? Is it the same time even? You don't know. So that's where we came. Sorry, one more thing. There is one very important thing, and this is the positioning. I showed you how I do the positioning with this glass and the paper, this positioning to find the axis. If you don't find the right axis, you make very severe errors. What you see here are the same profile tilted in three different ways, and if you look at the other side, you see that this corresponds to a cooking pot, this is correspond to other thing, this is correspond to a bowl. The position and the size is very important to give you the right vessel from which the fragment was taken. So in order to avoid archaeological misinterpretation, one has to really find the proper positioning, both the axis, both its tilt and its position relative to the fragment. Well, that's where we came in, and we said that the future has arrived. In the industry right now, there are now three-dimensional scanning cameras. What they do is to project on the object what is called structured light. The light is measured. You don't see it very well here. There are two cameras, one on top of one on above. It's like two eyes. You can do now the sophisticated electronics. The objects are put on a rotating table. And there is a very good, very sophisticated software. Here you see it in action. This is the computer, which brings you at the end of the day a very accurate and show you the accuracy of the shards with which you started. And you see here it is a triangulated surface. The accuracy in this case is less than 0.1 millimeter. So it is quite accurate determination. And the speed is 600 per day. So with this speed, we can really cover an excavation and we don't discard any data. So the data is intact, is immaculate. We did not subject it to pre-selection, but for the selection of the indicative rims, which is arbitrary. We believe it is random. So what we did was to, we had to develop a software for the determine, so you given such a three-dimensional shape, we have to develop a software which will finally give you the profile. And then you can do the analysis. And this is not a very easy job because the surface is not a perfect surface. It has stretches, indentation, and also it has, because it is broken, it has parts which are not part of the, not surface of rotation. And you have to eliminate them if you want, you don't know it a priori.
Why can't you stay at the three-dimensional model level to do the comparisons? Why do you have to go to the drawing level?
One reason, because they don't have the same size as it. And then the storage of three, it is much more easy to analyze two-dimensional lines in the plane than three-dimensional objects. You can do various things. I'll show you in a minute. The information content is the same. The difficulty is also that the fragments are quite small. They extend very small angle. And one has to have a stability and efficiency that it will work and be of use. Here comes the question, what is a normal? So this I call the hairy fragment. And the hairs are the normals at each point. Very easy to compute the normal of a triangle. Once you have the triangle. And then what we use is the fact that all the normals of a body of revolution intersect in the axis of rotation. And those which are far off from an assumed or first guess normal belong to something wrong, something which is not a part of the... So one can remove these parts from the analysis. And what you see here is after the analysis, once we have found the axis of rotation, you take all the points and you project them on one plane which is inside, which intersects the axis of rotation. So this, you just remove the angular degree of freedom and you only look at the distance. And then you see here all the points of the shard projected in this way, and here projected only those which do not satisfy the normal condition. And you see that the projection is very clean. So this is very efficient, and it's very important in the analysis. The second question is how to determine the axis. Well, it is very not good to compute normals in usually, because that means that you do numerical differentiation. So what you do is slightly different. You use either the both facts that you can find a plane which is perpendicular to the, sorry, parallel or tangent to the rim. The other method is that if you cut a object, a surface of revolution, by planes which are perpendicular to the axis, then the centers of the circles which are cut by this plane are all on the axis. This is the cut. This is the outside of the fragment, the inside, and this point is the center. And by doing an iterative process, you can get finally that all the points which define the axis by projection downwards coalesce to a point. The size here, you start with the errors which are in the range of millimeters, and you end up in a cloud which is the size of a few microns. So it really converges to a point. If the projection is not a point, then it is a line, and out of this line we get the way to correct the angle. So You can do it, and the resulting thing, just to... So you see how, if you take this plane, you turn it around the axis, you get really the same different parts of the same profile, and that is the object which we are interested in. Then you can project all the points on this plane, the common plane. You can determine, you can, once it is converged, you can see it. This is the increase of this part of the picture. You can compute the center of mass of this line along this line, and you get the average profile. And you can also use the width of this line as a measure to the quality of the fit. The thinner it is, the better the fit. In order to check our method, what we did was to produce a ring in the workshop, take its photograph, scan it, and what we obtained is a cloud of center points, which is of the order of 2 microns, so this is a very good thing. And then also we studied the dependence of the accuracy of this, or the radius of this circle as a function of the size, angular range of the rim. And you see that up to the point at 1 millimeter accuracy is somewhere around 15 degrees. So that's the limit of our method, which is 10 degrees better than everything existing. So here are some results. We analyzed last year, just before the war started in Lebanon, we analyzed some 800 fragments. And these are the ones that you see here. Some of them are bad. We see that this one is actually broken, and you see that the profile that you get is not very good. What can you expect? And this is a summary of the advantages of the system. But the main thing is that out of the 800 fragments which we scanned, 95 we could definitely obtain a proper profile, which is much, it is 2 orders of magnitude better than anything that one expects in archaeology. Okay, now suppose that we have all the fragments and all their shapes, what do we do with it? So the first thing is we have now lines and we have to analyze them, the shapes. Here is the line. This is the Egyptian cup. This is its profile. It has a rim. This is the center. Now we can express the it in terms of various functions, either the distance from the axis as a function of the arc position along the arc, the length of along the arc, S, or the angle of the tangent, or, of course, the curvature. And this is just the distance. You see that this line has not many features, and the rim, which is so important, appears as a small indentation. If you go to the tangent, it appears as a discontinuity, almost. And if you look at the curvature, you see a sharp peak. This little thing, which appears here, doesn't almost appear in this picture. Here it is a small thing, but here it is, I think it is the other way around, never mind. You see a large jump here, which is the result of of this little element. So of course, I don't have to explain further. If one is interested in the places where the change of the shape are maximal, one can study these functions as the indicative functions for the further analysis. This is a nice picture, which is good only for archaeologists, because it explains what a curvature is in terms of the local radius, the radius of curvature, and this is a film which shows you that this shape can be described by this function. And the red is where the curvature becomes negative. So you see, and I even have somewhere a picture. Okay, so this is how now we believe that this is equal to this. And you see how nice the various features of the profile are given in terms of the sharp spikes in the curvature. So let's question is, one question is how to define a prototype. Sometimes the archaeologists tell you, look, these five or seven plates define a prototype, and then analyze the data according to this prototype. So this is an example with two profiles, this one and this one. You just generate the average. Curvature, out of the curvature, you get this profile. This is a virtual profile, but this is your type. This defines your type. As a matter of fact, one can work in the... The trouble is, as I said to this gentleman that who asked the question, that the shapes are not the same. This was broken here, this was broken there. You have to compare, but then if you, since you know that the point, the top point corresponds to the rim, you can always normalize this to be point number, you measure the distance from that point, and you go on equal distance with respect, you use the radius as the dimension, and then you can see that two pots, which the two curvature lines which look like that, if you position them properly, then you see that they are quite similar. And then you can define various mathematical quantities like the metric. So you just take the L2 norm and the you have a weight function which tells you which part of the object you would like to emphasize. You can define correlations, and you can do whatever linear algebra that you would like to do in order to make the analysis. So this is a trick which we introduced, and we used it, and we found some nice things. So what I would like to speak about are a few examples where we did actually solve some problems. Well, the first thing are problems which have to do with the methodological questions about pottery in archaeology. And the question are these. Can a single section, when you describe the entire vessel, you have a handmade vessel, maybe it is not completely symmetric, can you define a single one which will distinguish it and which will keep the similarity going? And the other one, can a potter reproduce a type? Can the same potter reproduce the same kind of vessels? The first example which we analyzed were several, more than 10, but I don't remember if 11 or 15 flower pots, which we ordered in a pottery in Hebron, it is a Palestinian town, and it is a modern potter using a traditional kick wheel. So this is quite a slow wheel. The one which you saw was electrical wheel. And then we took the result, one of the pots, you put it on two, between two levels. Here the bubble is in the middle, so it stands on a horizontal plane. Here the bubble is completely on the side. It means that this plane and this plane are not parallel, and therefore you cannot reproduce this vessel with a single profile. This profile is not equal to this profile.
Why don't you put it the other way around? This may be just slicing the bottom.
Because we want to know the truth. And then we remember what the archaeologists did. They tell us all the time that really the whole vessel is not so important. What is important is the shape of the rim. So what we did was to do that. So what we did was the following. We took, measured all these 15 pots or whatever. We measured for each of them six. We extracted six profiles. Oops. And then did the analysis by considering for the analysis the shape of the vessel up to this point. Point number one, up to this level, two, three, four, and five was the entire shape. And then we did the correlation work and found... And found the intra-vessel uniformity and the inter-vessel uniformity. So we measured the uniformity comparing profiles within the same vessel, average over all the vessel, or the average correlation between different profiles of different vessels. And if the analysis, if the assumption of the archaeologist is right, then these correlations should be very high and quite similar. And indeed they are. The intra-vessel uniformity, the the deformity of a single vessel is near 90% on average, it's not bad, and the intra-vessel, so the inter-vessel between them is also not so bad, it's 80% on average. This is when you consider only the rim. When you consider the entire body, as you progress, the correlation becomes worse, the archaeologists are right. So they're experienced, they know what they're saying. If you analyze the rim area, you are about to get the same style from the same potter at least. Here is so this was the methodological part. What I would like to speak about now is actually a problem that we solved in archaeology. In Palestine, there are two cities in the Bronze Age. This is the Iron Age, the time after 1200 or so. One of them is called Hazor, and the other one is Tyre. Hazor is somewhere near the Sea of Galilee in the east. It was the main Canaanite town. It's mentioned in the Bible many times. It was a very large tell, one of the biggest tells in Palestine, very important, and it has a large area which it controlled, the city controlled, with a lot of fertile land and very good products. Tyre was the capital of the Phoenician people, and they were at that time exporting and importing all kinds of goods, wine, grains, all over the Middle East. Now, the vessels in which these commodities were exchanged and interchanged and transferred were this bowl, which people call torpedo bowl because they look like a torpedo, but they are storage jars which were put on a camel, not on a camel, on a donkey, and they take it away or put on a ship. Now, they found similar torpedo storage jars from the same period, in Tyre, 24 of them, and in Hazor, 53 of them. And three articles were written by three lady archaeologists. Lady number one said that these, the Tyre torpedo jars were actually produced in Hazor and being sent with grains from Hazor to Tyre. The lady who was digging in Tyre, Mrs. Bikai, said that not only did she find the torpedo jars, she found also the kiln where they were made. And therefore, it's the other way around. They were produced in Hazor, in Tyre, and were sent with wine or grain or any import goods to Hazor. Mrs. Gilboa, who belongs to our group, she says a word which starts with B hyphen, T. It's all wrong. They are not similar at all. Look at them. Two of them are from Hazor. Two of them are from Tyre. You'll say that they are the same. So what we did was to do this analysis, the analysis of the curvature, and we got the following correlation matrix, in which the first 50-something were 50-whatever bowels are from Hazor, the last were put are from Tyre. The correlation is scale is given by the color, and what you see is that the Tyre ensemble is more uniform, more correlated, and not very much correlated with what's going on in Hazor. Well, if you do another correlation, the same data but represented as a tree, and you see that one branch is almost entirely black, the other one is almost entirely red, with of course outlier, but the level where the branches separate is around 75%. So indeed, the material, they are very similar. But if you do this analysis, which emphasizes such small details, the difference comes out. And then you can do various summary of the data. And for example, you see that all the Tyre live here, most of the Hazor live here with a large with some kind of a line going through to the other side, or expresses in this way, you see that the Tyre and the Chatzor are near their mean value, so they are quite separate from each other. And I think that Mrs. Gilboa is correct. There is not much, at least this is the data that we can do. Every theory of archaeology which wants to speak now about correlations of commerce should face this thing. If you look at the elementary books about Palestinian or biblical archaeology, you'll find this example as a classical, Ami Mazar in his book, classical example of commerce between two towns. I don't think he's right, or at least not very. After we published this data, somebody did the analysis of the mineralogy of the clay, and the result of this work confirms what we said. So there are two. None of the results is smoky gun, but they are consistent. Another group is something which is called Kfar Hanania Ware. Excuse me. Kfar Hanania, this village here, sits on a geological fault. And next to it, there is a singularity, a geological singularity, where there is very special kind of clay. Red, very thin, out of which one can produce also thin ceramics. You can burn them to high temperature, and they are very resistant to heat. In this particular little village, 400 years are known to be a main source of production of pottery. And it is mentioned in the Talmud, in the Jewish sources of the Talmud, Mishnah, it is called the Kfar Hanania Ware. It is like in this country, if you say, please bring me your Hoover, you don't mean to go to the factory of Hoover and to collect it is a vacuum cleaner. So this is a generic name, like Hoover for vacuum cleaner here, that is Kfar Hanania, is a generic name for a particular kind of ware, and they are very important because of the kashrut rules and whatever, they are mentioned many places. Okay. Now, this was excavated by a team from Bar Ilan University, David Adan Bayevich, and what they did was to dig, and they classified the various ware according to some archaeological criteria. They found several places which were kiln, which were production sites. One of them is I-31. It is a kiln deposit. This is the place where all the junk, all the waste products of a kiln are thrown. And they also know where the kiln is, I mean where the actual fire was made. Another place is another kiln, but there they didn't dig deep, they dig from the surface. So this is supposed to be pure source. It is the only this source. The ware which the fragments found from here correspond really to the same workshop, whereas here this must be a little bit more dirty. It is not because it is more shallow dig. And what did we do? We obtained from them around few tens of fragments of this type from this deposit, another from the other dig. And the question was, can we differentiate between different potters on the basis of the same analysis? And this is the kind of fragments that we get. And this is the same similar analysis. And if you look, if you can see the colors, one distribution looks like that, the other one looks like that. This is the principal component analysis. This is really the principal component analysis. And you see the points are quite separated. This is the correlation matrix. So if you do an analysis of a large amount of data, you can see the differences. And after we've done the analysis, and looking back at the profiles, we can actually point to the archaeologists, look, this detail is different in the two production line places. And indeed, in many cases, you could see the difference. The same for another type. This is a ball. And again, you see the difference between the blue points and the red points is coming out. And I think this is the first time ever that people could distinguish between distributions from the same village, from the same period, but different periods. I can also speak a little bit about other applications, and here it is the hand axes. And I was very happy that in this learned city, which is center of learning, in the year of our Lord 2006, they advocate in a very important journal of archaeology to use calipers to measure stones. You see, they call it a cross-beam coordinate caliper for the for metric analysis of lithic nuclei, blah, blah. Now, I call this 17th century high-tech. You know, to use calipers to measure stones. Because a better way to do it is to take it to the scan it. And with the same camera, we are now have scanned hundreds and hundreds of such things, stones. And you have the three-dimensional without a caliper. So you have the entire information. And then the main question is how to hold it, how to position it. So I proposed to compute a tensor of the normals. This tensor has the property that its largest eigenvalue, the eigenvector corresponding to the largest eigenvalue, is a direction which is most parallel, which is parallel to most of the normals. It's very simple. So you look at it, you position it according, so these are the various eigenvectors, you can position it according to this thing, and then it is very easy matter to obtain cross-sections, measures, and whatever you don't want. We compute also the center of gravity, something which was never computed. And if you want to understand the function of this, how this was held, then you better know not only its moment of inertia, not only its center of gravity, but also its moment of inertia. You connect it sometimes to a handle. You want to know where is the center of percussion. And what we are doing now with this data is to give it to robotic people who have models of the palm of the hand, and by trying to find what is the most efficient way to hold this stone in order to get a particular usage. Another application is to find die siblings, you know, of coins. Coins were struck by putting a disc of metal on a mold, on a die. Put it, you take the other part, you hit it by a hammer, and then you produce a two-sided coin. This is, by the way, called oboli. It's a very cheap coin. It's extremely small. It is about 6 millimeters across, what you see here, and look at the details. As you see here, this is a. Here was an A, the Athena. On the other side, you have the picture of Athena, and this is the owl, which was the picture of one of the symbols of Athena. And the question is whether you can identify if or not the two coins, these two coins were produced by the same die. These are called die siblings. And if one can identify such things, and you find such a coin in Alexandria in Egypt, and the other one in Antiochia in Syria, you can say that there was some commerce, or you can say some things in archaeology. But this is not exactly the case, because there are various differences. The question is, are these differences of importance or not? But these are to be analyzed. This is the coin on the other side. And again, if you want to look what you get from the measurement and the scanning, you can also have by the time it takes, you can have an idea how heavy the files are. This one corresponds to 349,000 triangles, quite heavy. But you see quite nicely Athena, and then you can see all. I can never properly find it, but you see the all. So this three-dimensional information is very important, both in archaeology and another aspect I didn't speak about it. If you have gone to the British Museum or any other big museum, and there is an exhibition of coins, usually what there is, they put the coin, they put it on a mirror so you can see the other side. You put in front of it a large lens, which is quite small, and then people are pushing each other to see if they are in Israel. I mean, if they are in London, they stay in line, in queue. One by one, they go in to look at it. Imagine that the same is done by this method. Once you scan it, first of all, you can show it on a wall. Children can play with it with a joystick and see all the details. Secondly, you don't even have to show the very precious coins. You can store them in the safe, and then they are not being stolen. And then you can only show this. And I think using this, which for some reason is not yet popular, and I'm working to make it popular, it has not yet found its application in a real exhibition, but this will also come.
I'm finishing.
Well, the applications for computer and mathematical ideology can be many in landscape archaeology, architecture, stratigraphy, and interactive display, which I've shown you about previously. Anybody of you who wants to join at each stage of this work, most welcome. And this is the end. Thank you.
Any questions?
Plenty of, not the questions, but sort of the answers and the techniques, remind me of computer-aided geometric design.
Yes.
CAGD, computer-aided geometric design.
Yes.
Again, you have objects or part of the object or some of the objects are occluded.
Uh-huh.
And you have somehow to compare them and to rotate them find the right metric to rotate in order to compare and so on. Did you talk with people?
Yes. You see, these cameras are not... This is the shape. This is the camera. Here you see the structured light projector and the two cameras. These setups are not made for archaeology. They are made for robotics, for reverse engineering, and engineering dental work, and such things. What we do is to use what they prepare in terms of the analysis to give us the triangulated surface, and from there on we continue. What happens usually is that if you try just to take a ready-made off-the-shelf material, then you finally have to develop it yourself, because the particular problems are different and the applications are different, so it's sometimes better to think a little bit, to make all the possible mistakes, of course, to spend a little bit more time, but then you know what you're doing and you understand why you do it. So and then also it is much more amenable to changes for other applications. So I do speak with people in computer science, both in Rehovot and in Technion and in Haifa University. Questions like, for example, how to compute numerically a curvature. We found a more satisfactory way to do it than what was published in the literature. So maybe we didn't look at all the literature, but we looked at books and papers, we Googled. So in that respect, I think all the smoothing, how to introduce the correct smoothing. So I say that we definitely do not invent the wheel, and many of the ideas appear and are used in various similarities in various other applications. But all in all, I think is more fitting, especially because we are all the time in contact with the archaeologists. Because what it means to have a good fit is what they, or a good similarity is what they consider as good similarity. What are the parameters which you really want to compare? So this is where we are.
Other questions? But what is the typical time scale for the significant changes of the shape.
Sorry? Ah, the typical?
Yes.
That depends. This is...
No, I'm talking about...
in archaeology. In archaeology, you mean?
Yes.
That depends very much on the history. You see, the history of the world is of civilization is usually built in cycles. You know, grosso modo, it is cycles. There is a time where there is stability, everything goes slowly, everybody is happy, and then suddenly some bad people come, ruin the culture, start again. There were periods in which the Mediterranean in the 1500 years before Christ was a very active, intensive international commerce. There were ships which were going along the Mediterranean coast and then coming to Cyprus, to Turkey, to Greek, to Mykene, Egypt, and then Crete, Egypt, and then continue. Copper was mined in Cyprus. They needed tin for making bronze. The tin came from Afghanistan on donkeys. Mari, to the Euphrates, to the north of Syria, there is a town, Ebla, which was a port. They found ships near the coast of Turkey, where they found ingots of copper, ingots of tin, in the right proportion, 1 to 10. Hundreds of them. They found ebony from Africa, the teeth of a hippopotamus. Hippopotamus from Egypt. They found ivory. So in this period, there were 200 years of slow development. Then suddenly, the people of the seas, the Philistines, were driven away from Mykene, from Greece, and went and ruined a large part of the East Mediterranean. Then there was a big break. Many towns fell apart, and then you have to start again. The Philistines brought their pottery to where they were really settling. So you can see Mykene-style pottery made of local clay in Israel. So they brought they didn't bring their own vessels, they brought with them the culture. And the culture was very different. In Egypt, there was also a disruption. I told you, the example, the Hyksos. Suddenly, instead of the old traditional Egyptian culture, suddenly Semitic names. The donkey became a holy animal. And then the evolution is very fast. So this is the answer. Typically, I think you can see 50 years different, 10 years different, depending on what is the
characteristic. According to British Museum, in Golden Age in Greece, 5th century BC,
yes.
Ceramic changes dramatically each 30 years. That, completely different color, shape, everything was different.
That, as I say, depends on the place and the history.
Other questions? If not, let's thank.